do you know? Now, are you going to ask me questions?
Yes.
Yeah, that'll be good, and then that's easier. I can offhand get...
By golly, it looks like it's working. Now, if you would start out by telling me your name, and...
Well, I'm Esther Oliver Hall.
Esther Oliver Hall. Yes. And Mike Dalton did interview you at Central.
Yes, she did. She has a tape somewhere that she...
And you told her about your life. You were born in Douglas?
I was born in Douglas, Alaska in 1899, the 31st day of August. And prior to that, my mother and father had lived in Sitka. They came into Sitka, I presume, about, in the early 80s, 1880s. My father worked for W.P. Mills there, who was a store man, and I believe my father ran a sawmill. They were married in Sitka by Bishop Rowe and lived there for several years and then moved over to Douglas, where my father worked in the big Treadwell mills. I attended grade school and high school in Douglas, graduated in 1916.
Now, when your dad was working at the mine as a child, did you ever go up to the mines?
No, and he did not work in the mines.
No.
He worked at the mills and later in the cyanide plant and later in the refinery. I went to the refinery to see the gold bricks being made.
You did.
But I did not ever go to the cyanide plant, of course. I had 2 years at Bellingham Normal School, which gave me an elementary diploma, and came back to teach school. My first school was at Perseverance Mine, which is several miles back of Juneau up in the mountains. It was an interesting place. The people lived down in the flat of the valley, and the mine was up, the entrance to the mine was at the top of the hill. So you rode a tramway to get up there. And during that year, I was privileged to go home each weekend to Douglas. So I would go to the, up the tramway, and then be taken down the shaft to the bottom of the mine, where I boarded a little steel car, which was built specially for people riding through and go through the long tunnel back of the ore cars to Thane. And I presume Thane, there isn't much of Thane left anymore. I know there isn't. Then you took a long tramway ride down the hillside to the dock, and I would take the old lone fisherman, the old ferry boat, over to Douglas and spend the weekend with my parents.
And there, of course, there was no bridge there then?
No. The bridge was something as children, I always think of that. It was as far away as, well, we just thought it was something they talked about. We never dreamt. So I was very surprised in my later years to go back and find the Douglas Juneau Bridge. And also to find that Douglas had become sort of a suburb of Juneau
in a respect,
sort of the bedroom, I guess they call it, of a city. You know, people lived over there, but there wasn't any industry over there anymore. While I was gone those 2 years, the Treadwell Mine flooded.
Oh, really?
And that completely, of course, there was nothing left in the town, because when they closed the mines, that's what the town existed on, was what they got from the mines. There was no industry at all.
Now, what about there was a mine on the Treadwell Mine, wasn't that on the Douglas side?
Yeah, that's the big mine that I'm talking about. It was, and I think they took out an enormous amount of gold out of there, but it was low-grade oil. And you see, they had tunneled under to Gastineau Channel. And whether they went too near the surface or what, I don't know. Treadwell itself was quite a camp, was it, they called it. It had many company houses, had a company store where most everybody traded the company store, even though there were stores in the Douglas side of it. And it had a wonderful swimming pool. Thing was provided for their men in the way of entertainment. Big auditorium where they showed movies, bowling alleys, library. And as children, we were privileged to go there certain days to swim and to use the library.
Hmm. Let me ask a question, not relevant to what we're talking about, but something that I've been curious about through the years. We became American possession in 1867, and your father came, what, about 20-some years after that?
I would say so, yes. And there were still many Russians in Sitka at that time.
This is what I was going to ask about.
Yes, there were still many Russians in Sitka. And I presume that there are many descendants of those Russians there right now. And then my father also told me that there was much boat traffic between Kodiak and Sitka, because of course the Russians had Kodiak too, you
yes.
see. And he said he had the opportunity to go over there and work in a mill, but my mother didn't care to go, so he never did. He never went over. But he said there was a great deal of traffic.
Oh, a lumber mill.
Yes.
I was thinking of a mining mill.
No, a lumber mill. Yes. Uh-huh. And in our home, we had, sorry to say, I don't know what ever became of them. I didn't go out when my mother and father passed away. And we had many pictures, like the interior of the old church. And for a wedding present, W.P. Mills had sent to Germany and had sent prints of pictures of the old establishments in Sitka. And I think one came intact. And he gave that to my mother and father for a wedding present. And I have many, many pieces of that yet. I hope someday to give it to the museum here, because it belongs in Alaska. My daughter-in-law has it now, enjoys using them. But it really belongs back here in Alaska.
Hmm.
And then they had many other things, beautiful baskets and tusks and, oh, innumerable things that they had collected when they were in Sitka.
When you were a youngster in Juneau, were the Indians...
In Douglas, pardon me.
Yes. Were the Indians still...
There was quite a village.
Yes.
There was. But they were entirely separate of the town. To my knowledge, there were only a couple of part Native children who ever came to our school. In a way, I think back on that, and I think, well, they talk about racial prejudice. Maybe that was that we had it in Alaska. Because it took me a long time to realize that they, too, were people.
Well, you know, this question of race is an interesting thing. I had two Chinese friends, one from northern China and one from southern China, and I knew them 20 years apart, really.
Yes.
But at one point, there was the first Chinese I knew from southern China, he remarked that he was unhappily married. His wife was from northern China, and he says, you know, they're wheat eaters up there. And 20 years later, I knew a girl out at the Geophysical Institute, and she was from northern China, and she had been unhappily married, and she said to me, quote, and I couldn't believe my ears. She said, well, he's Cantonese, southern Chinese, you know, and they're rice eaters down there.
Isn't that astounding?
I had never forgotten this other remark,
no.
And here was the compliment to it, and I thought, my gosh, we in Caucasian think of the Chinese as a consolidated whole.
Absolutely.
And here they are as fragmented.
Yes,
and,
true.
And it is a sad thing that people do this with each other.
That is true, and I hope someday the day will come.
Yeah, I hope so.
Now, whether that rests on the young people of our country, I think it does. I don't know whether they've helped
well,
the matter.
I think there's a great deal of change. We're in a period of great change.
We are, amazingly. Things happen that you never expected could ever happen.
Yes.
And I've always felt that we, too, grew up with a racial prejudice right in that little village, that little town of Douglas.
Yes, it existed there.
It existed there, absolutely.
Going back to the Russian thing, did your father or your parents speak of the feelings of the Russians? Did you pick up any ideas or thoughts about them as a youngster?
No, I really can't say that I did. No, I really
just,
can't.
Curious about that. In southeastern Alaska, some years ago, I talked to people that still had feelings, and back in the 50s,
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
And I don't mean any hostility, but
no.
They have memories of the. Their parents had seen the flag change.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
But now going on to your life, then as a child in Douglas, growing up there, it was really a small town.
Very small, very
3,000
small.
3,000 people?
I imagine, yes.
And did you, the glaciers I think were much larger then. I'm asking some strange questions, probably,
yeah.
That nobody else
that,
has.
Yes, I can't say. We, as children, we used to go out to Mendenhall occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And during high school years, we'd go for our senior and picnics out there and things like that. And frankly, you know, it's amazing to me now when I look back on my childhood, I rarely ever went to Juneau.
Is that so?
Yes, I rarely ever went to Juneau. It was quite an occasion when I was taken to Juneau.
Now, was Juneau a much larger community? Or about the same?
I would say that it was larger than Douglas. Uh-huh.
It wasn't the capital yet then, was it?
Well, it was when I was a child. And the first legislature took place, because I had an uncle that went from Douglas.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. To the first legislature. And that was way back in, I don't know, I can't remember dates.
Mm-hmm. In the early 1900s.
Yes. But that started. And I don't recall that we were ever taken over there. Now they would take them over to as high school students, but we were never. Our high school was very little. In our graduating class, there were two people, another girl and I graduated, very small.
What did you study then in high school?
Well, we had English and history. We did not have chemistry. We had physics. We had no chemistry laboratory. We studied Latin.
Basic curriculum at that time.
Yes.
One didn't go into the humanities.
Never. In fact, it took me a long time to realize what the humanities were. You know, I didn't realize.
You didn't have basketball.
So then after I had taught that year at Perseverance, and that was during the World War One, and this mine was financed by English capital. And after World War One, they closed it down, so that was the last school that they had at Perseverance, that school that I had at 1918 and 1919. So then the next year, and L.D. Henderson, I must go back to him too, he was our first Commissioner of Education.
Yes.
And he was just a marvelous person, and we all, you know, and helpful to all of us, you know. And so then he asked me if I would like to go into the Esca coal mines out of Anchorage.
Oh.
So I went into Anchorage in the fall of 1919, and it was just a little place, and rode the train out to the coal mines.
Jonesville.
And the community had put up the school. The territory had provided the lumber and all, but they did the work, the men, and they had some very excellent workmen. And so they held an open house, and I remember an orchestra went out from Anchorage, you know, on this train that I went out, and it was really quite an event. And the interesting thing to me was that the first person I met, well, then the mine superintendent's wife met me and took her right home, and here were two or three men out on the porch freezing ice cream because you froze your own for getting ready for the big party at the school, the opening of the school. And really the first person I met was Dixie Hall, the man I married. And then another little sidelight to that.
Oh, well,
was
he wasn't making ice cream.
Yes, he was turning the handle on one of these things. And so I met him and met the other. So when he went back to the bunkhouse, the man said, "Well, what does the new school marm look like?" "She's the biggest woman I ever saw in my life. I was very tall." And that was always kind of a family joke among the family. And I always say, "I got him anyway." No, we weren't. We knew each other for two or three years before we became interested in one another. And I taught there 2 years. And then Mr. Smith, the Sumner S. Smith, who was a mining engineer, was transferred up to the Chickaloon Mines. It was a Navy coal mine.
Wasn't if you'd had any action.
No. Right here on the seal. Pick it up on the tape.
Oh! Okay, I'll be back.
All right. And he asked me if I would like to go up and take the school there. And I was delighted. I spent 2 years at ESC at the school and enjoyed every minute of it. I suppose I was real flattered. I was the only young girl in camp, so received much attention, you know. And it was a nice camp to work in. And so I went up to Chickaloon and spent my year there. And Dix and I were married then in 1922, May the 6th, 1922, in Anchorage. Then he was transferred over to keep time on the big bridge at Nenana. So we moved to Nenana, where we spent 7 years, and our children were... One was born in Anchorage and one was born in Fairbanks.
Now, whom did he work for?
He worked for the railroad, for the Alaska Railroad. When it was under the...
Well, that was the railroad then that operated the coal mine at Esca.
Yes, well, they used the coal out of Esca, yeah. But the Chickaloon coal was operated by the Navy, and this man had been sent up there. And there were quite a group of Navy people there, so there was a lot. And Chickaloon was a wonderful community, and no people don't know about Chickaloon. It was, the houses were all lovely homes were built on the hillside, and you had to walk up about 80 steps before you reached the top of the hill. And down in the flat was a big community hall, was a hospital, well, just every, and a big dining room, just anything that, you know, a mining camp would have. And and then that year they put up a big cleaning plant down at Sutton to work in connection with this coal mine. Well, then I don't know just what happened, but it all closed down. I suppose it was a matter of appropriation because it was all territory then, you see, and everything came out of Washington, D.C. And then, as I say, then Dix and I lived at Nenana for 7 years. He later went to work for the Northern Commercial Company, was with them. And we were then sent down to the Bethel, down on the Bering Sea coast, and we lived there for 4 years. It was a very little village, and there were probably six white families. The Moravian missionaries were there, and And we were there, and our children were the white children, went to the school, got along very nicely, and Eskimo children were just, I loved them all. I loved the old grandmothers.
Now, did you teach there?
No, I did not teach. No, I never taught after I was married.
I see.
That was the end of my teaching career.
That was the end of your teaching for the school system?
Yes.
You just taught your children at home?
And then we had our children, and we came up to Fairbanks then in 1933, and this has been home ever since.
Yes. And you were involved at Central?
No, I always go over there in the summertime and visit. My husband and I, after Dick's retired from the clerk of the court's office, which he held many, many years, we loved the Circle Country. We've always camped over there and spent a lot of time over there. And Ken Carson took over the hot springs and had an ad in the paper that he would like to rent cabins for the winter. So we thought it'd be fun to just spend a winter, and it's a beautiful place. It was a beautiful place to spend a winter. You know, and it was just lovely. The northern lights were just marvelous, just everything about it. Yeah, the moon looked like you could touch it, you know, you were so near everything, and it was just wonderful. And we stayed there 5 years.
You did?
Yes, we did. We lived over there 5 years, and we had a camper. We'd go away in the summertime if we wanted to, and go outside if we wanted, but we always went back to the springs. And that's when John Burdall had it. I went over last summer, and it had so completely changed that I was very sorry. Just like a man told me today, he went over for the first time, and he couldn't believe it, because they have put in this beautiful swimming pool, but in doing that, they've destroyed something that, you know, we had always enjoyed.
Yes, yes. Change does that
sometimes. And the change.
There are many kinds of
change. It will change. It'll become very commercial, I have a feeling, which is sad. And since Dix died in 1967, I have spent my summers here and my winters in Sacramento with a family out there.
And how many children did you have?
I have just two boys. I have a boy that lives here and a boy that lives out there.
A boy here in Fairbanks?
Yes, I do.
And what is his name?
Well, right now he supervises the loading of the big Mercs. He's one of the men that does that. Hercules planes.
For Alaska International Airlines?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he's doing now. That's, as he said, that's his part in the Alaska pipeline, I guess.
Well, that's a pretty big part. They're going 24 hours a day.
Yes, it does. That's right.
Well, we still have quite a bit of time left. Oh, yes. Could we go back and when you were living in Douglas, did you get out of Douglas into any other region of Southeastern?
No, I did not. And our only transportation was the Alaska Steamship Boat.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think back now, I think fare to Seattle was about $25, you know. But we didn't take it very often. We didn't go out very often, you know. Once in a while, we'd take a trip out. But we just stayed.
Well, $25 then was a man's wages for quite a period of time.
Yes, when I started teaching, I made $120. And I remember the supervisor at the normal school said to me, well, I think I'll give up my job and go to Alaska. And I suppose in that year, it was it was a good salary.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Hard to believe now, isn't it? $120 doesn't go very far.
Well, the relative buying power was... Thinking back when I'm a Depression baby. I grew up in the 30s.
Uh-huh.
And my mother would give me 10 cents and say, now spend it carefully, that'll buy a loaf of bread. And a loaf of bread is 89 cents today.
Isn't it? It's just amazing.
Yes, and I can remember talking about how expensive it was to live in Alaska. They, when we talked about coming up here in the 40s, they said, I think a loaf of bread was a dollar in some places. We had heard that. And that was impossible to believe. And now we think it's reached that again. It's pretty impossible.
Well, it's strange with myself. Since I've lived all my life with prices, you know, and of course in Southeastern it was always the freight that added the prices. I'm not conscious of high prices. I remember people would say to me, I remember a lady came one time, and she was asking me what I paid for butter. And I said, well, I don't know. And she looked at me, because we had to have butter. It didn't make any difference. You paid the price.
That's right.
And when you've grown up in that atmosphere, you don't have it isn't the right value of money, I'll tell you. And my sons to this day have always said, Mother, you never taught us the value of money. I didn't know it myself. It just wasn't that we had a lot of money, but money was to spend.
Isn't that interesting? Yes?
Because you're not conscious of that. And when I went to California, I was astounded when I hear people stand in front of the tomatoes or the celery, and the celery probably was 15 cents a bunch, and we had paid, a dollar and a quarter. It wasn't anything for us to pay for a bunch of celery. And you see, those people used to just stop. I couldn't believe it. I just used to think, well, what's the matter with these people? But then, you know, you aren't out there very long before. And another thing I could never get used to was people picking up a vegetables and examining it and putting it back and picking up something else. We were glad to have exactly what we got.
I was talking with Magdalene Cassidy yesterday.
Yes.
And she said that during the war here, when the Russians came in, that food was so scarce because they had money to spend and they bought everything they could get their hands
on. That is right. They said they had these great big, I don't remember, the old bills, great big old bills that they'd had those over there all those years. And Harry Avakoff, I know, told Dixie that if he could get enough watches, he could become a millionaire right then. Because they did. They bought a... And in the stores, it astounded the people what they bought. It didn't make any difference how old-fashioned or old anything. Well, they just wanted goods, material, or anything, you know. And they said that, you know, washing machines and things like that, they took them out here. They would come over here, you see, and then fly those planes back.
I was just wondering how they got them home. I guess they just
put them in the airplane.
Yeah, I can see them. Yeah. I can see them at a washing machine strapped into the seat
of
a fighter plane.
That's right. And imagine, and because I know we had a friend, a young chap who was a squadron, of the when they were flown in from the outside, and he said, when you turn those planes over to those people, all they were interested in was the gun that was on those planes. That was what they were interested in.
Hmm.
He said it was interesting to, and of course they lived very much themselves here, you know. They were not allowed to mix with the general public.
By their own mandate.
That's right.
Not by America.
No. By their own, whoever was doing the calling off over there. And they did. They practically took everything out of this town that they could, so it was short. Madeline was right.
Yeah. She was saying that... her husband worked at PNC Company.
Yes, I know he did.
And if she knew the grocer, and he'd call her up and say, "We've got some bananas in today," or whatever.
You better come quick, I guess.
Yes. And she able to get things, I guess.
Yeah.
Not by preference necessarily.
No, but just because they worked for PNC Company.
But now you were here in Fairbanks during the war. Also.
Yes, I was. Oh yes.
That I guess actually Alaska was not as sensitive, or
we weren't. We thought when people decide they couldn't, you know, a lot of people would come in, decide they wouldn't stay after Pearl Harbor. No, after
Attu
was struck. You know, after they invaded down there. Well, none of us thought that was the thing to do because this was our home. This is where we belonged, right here. We had to take what was handed us, I guess. But a lot of the people who hadn't spent too many years in Alaska did go.
Yes,
and of course, I know in the schools it was hard. The windows were all blacked over. We had, and as soon as it got dark, we had to put blackout things in our windows, you know. We weren't allowed to have light showing anywhere. So,
of course, the mines all closed down, but I guess the military activity kept the place alive.
It did. It kept it alive. In fact, I think it was more prosperous than it had been for a long time, you see. So,
now, you came to Nenana about 10 years after the railroad was put through.
Well, and I was there the day of the Golden Spike, and I was so disappointed last year, which I've heard many people say who would have gone to it. It wasn't given enough publicity.
Oh, wasn't that
no.
sad? That was this last year when they
had the 50 years, and I was there that 50 years.
You were?
Yes, I was.
You went up there in 23 then?
In 22.
22?
Yes.
President Harding was
there? President Harding came. They had a reception for him. They organized a town band, which was the funniest band you ever heard in your life. I always wondered what he thought about it, but the townspeople did everything. We had ladies dressed up in their very best dresses and went to the reception down to the depot for them. And,
I've heard a few stories about that. As I recall, he was supposed to go on up the river or something on a riverboat trip from there, but didn't she become ill or something happened? They changed their plans.
Oh, I don't recall. I really don't
recall.
But you
weren't living at Nenana there.
Yes, yeah, so when they were there, we were living there. See, that was in 20, when they come in, 23 or 24? Yes, we were there. It must have been in 23. I remember I had a brand new dress and everything.
I see. So you had, then you married, when was it you married?
I was married in Anchorage on the 6th day of May, 1922, and we came into Nenana.
Oh, you did. Mm-hmm. I thought that you, from there, you went back to something. You went. I thought you went back up to Chickaloon.
No.
You went to Nenana at that time.
Well, yes. I went back to Chickaloon. That is true. I went back and finished a month of school.
I see.
And we wanted to be married by the Episcopalian minister in Anchorage, and so that's why we were married that early month, but otherwise it would not have been that way. But,
Now, yeah. There in Nenana, there's an interesting little Episcopal church.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's still operating or not.
I don't know either. I haven't asked anybody recently. I haven't been down there for a number of years. And I think they moved that church up from the mission. You see, they used to have a mission. The Episcopalians had a mission where they took children to board. And it all finally washed away with the river. You see, the river washed all the buildings down the river. And so, but they had saved the little church and moved it into town. You used to go out to that little church to church.
Did you?
Yes.
I wondered if you might not have.
Yes.
I've always wondered about the story of that church. There's a little sign on it that says when it was built.
Yes.
And so on. But
and there were we all enjoyed the missionaries. You know, mixed with the town people, were part of the town.
You did have Episcopal ministers who were resident in Nenana.
Yes, that's true. Down at the mission, and then there were several women who were missionary women that came in. Most of them were Southern women that came in there. And
I always think of Episcopal women as being the Church of England descendants.
Yes.
Of,
well, most of these women were Southern women that came in as missionaries there. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Very interesting. It was. We thoroughly enjoyed our 7 years in Nenana.
Well, that's right. You moved to Fairbanks in 1933 instead of 1933.
No, then we went to Bethel.
Oh, to Bethel for 4 years.
Yeah, and then for 4 years, and then up to Fairbanks.
I see. Yes, I now, the Moravian missions were the only ones there in Bethlehem.
Yes, they were at that time, and now I understand the Catholics are there, too. You see, it used to be that the territory was sort of divided up into sections, and, you know, each church had a section, and the Moravians were, and they were interesting people. They were very fine people. They came from, most of them were from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, you see. And evidently, they took a great pleasure in music, because the men had wonderful voices and some of the women had trained voices. And the Eskimos down there took a very active part in the church. They had their own choir, they had their own Bible that had been translated for them.
Mm-hmm. I have a story that I think is kind of a cute story. I was doing some field work in anthropology, ethnological.
I see.
Down at a little village called Mumtrak across from Good News Bay. And I went in there with this group, and my work was to go up to the general store and go over the records. The woman who was the general storekeeper, she was the daughter of the original trader there, and
yes,
he had married one
of
the local women. And she was their daughter, and then she'd married a man who had come in with the war. And so they'd remained and kept the store going, and real nice, interesting people. She'd been educated outside. But she also, she kept, as the most literate person in the village, she kept all the records. Among them, not only the store records, but the church records in Moravian Mission. And I wanted to do a census of the town and genealogy and this sort of thing, which the Moravian Mission records were, and her knowledge to supplement it was very, very good. So I compiled all of this information. Now she said, and every person in the village belonged to the Moravian Mission.
Yes.
Now she said, we do have another set of church records. She said, there is a Seventh-day Adventist summer camp over on the Kuskokwim. So she said, quite a few people have actually also joined Seventh-day Adventist Church. And they go to summer camp, but she says, you might get some more information off of that. So she pulled out those records and gave them to me here with the same name. So I wrote them down and did my little... So then a few weeks later, I was passing through Bethel on my way back to Anchorage. And I stopped over a couple of days with a girlfriend. And this girlfriend, her house had blown over. And she and her husband, they had been building a house on the edge of town, but they had a big wind and just blew the house away. So they were good Catholics, and Father Murphy had invited them to come and stay at the rectory, and he had moved into the church. So when I arrived in town, they had a spare bed in the rectory, so I went to the Catholic rectory. But we ate with Father Murphy. So I told Father Murphy what I had been doing at Mumtrak, and he said, my goodness, he says, it's been quite a time since I've been to Mumtrak, but we have quite a following down there. Just a minute, he says, I'll get my list and show you. And there they were, the same names again.
I know. And, you know, the Moravian missionaries used to laugh. One of the women used to say, you know, you have to have it. Let's see what you say. No, if the church is cold, you don't have anybody come. And she said, don't you ever fool yourself. The native is out looking for the most comfortable place to park himself for an hour, you know. And so I suppose when the Catholics came in and they offered them something, they'd take it. Each one, you see, they take it.
Well, you see, you know, this is a new thing to them, and I'm sure that has never occurred to them that the old Anglican or the Anglo-European tradition is, you know, the one path to God.
Absolutely. You don't get off that track.
No, so they were just taking all the paths
to God. They realized that down there. And then there was one missionary who'd been there for about 25 years, and he finally retired, and he said that. He said, you know, when I look back, he said, I sometimes wonder what I have accomplished. He said, because, you know, these people, regardless of what religion they take up, they still have their old beliefs, and they believe in them. And he said, I'm not too sure that that's right, if that is not right. He said, maybe we have, you know, come in and maybe he really doubted that.
I've made a lot of observations on that subject, and what I think, and this is not a historical discussion, this is strictly philosophical, but you know, I think Christianity has a lot of ethical, moral codes built into it, and the concept of love is a new concept to many people. The encompassing brotherly love concept, mm-hmm. and in fact, love is a foreign idea to many people as an impersonal principle. But it is a part of Christianity, impersonal love, mm-hmm. encompassing love, and I think that to give this idea to people, irregardless of whether they maintain old beliefs or whether they accept any particular method of worship or whatever, there are certain things in the concepts of Christianity that are not contained within any other religion. And these are very beautiful and very good and tremendously good principles to live by.
That's
irregardless
right.
of what your other
beliefs are. Yes, what your other beliefs are.
Yes.
Well, that's true.
And I think that in many cases, missionaries have done a lot of harm.
I do too. That now, they always refer to Hawaii as one place where they have had done a great deal of harm.
Well, I have a friend in Hawaii. She's a Hawaiian woman, and her mother, it's her family tradition to be, in Hebrew, the word rabbi means teacher. In Hawaiian, it escapes me just the very moment, but the word that they have for medicine man really means teacher. It means keeper of knowledge.
Oh.
I just can't think what it was, but there were the priestly class in Hawaii. She is descended from this, and she is a healer, and she is a practicing seer, prophetess,
yes.
and magical worker, and all this sort of thing. But she also endorses Christianity. I mean, she embraces Christianity as in her personal worship. She practices what we think of as pagan practices, but they are, in a sense, sciences for dealing mm-hmm. with the forces of the universe. And it is not anti-religious, or it's just a different kind of thing. But when she goes to worship, she recognizes the universal one God concept with the Jesus Christ teacher concept.
Well, you see. Maybe she has the right.
So, yes, who's to say? You know, I think there it's a wider field. I didn't mean to get into a theological discussion, but it's interesting.
Well, I think so, too. And as I say, that was the only man down there that heard express that. He doubted.
If they had necessarily
If they had really helped them.
Well, I think Christianity has been a good thing.
Yes, I imagine it has. And it probably has given them a lot of things. But
I know in a few places, certain sects have gone in. One of the islands, and I think it was a village on Savoonga area, what you call it, the far-out island. The big island, St. Lawrence,
yeah.
Some village on St. Lawrence, there was a sect that went in there that was extremely strict. They didn't believe in any kind of recreation, no dancing, no ceremonies, no reading, no nothing. And the incidence of insanity, and some doctor told me this years ago in Anchorage, the mental health problems became very acute there. And the professional health workers attributed it to the missionary ideas, because they said they just were not suited to a region where there was no recreation. It confined the people, and they had no outlet, and the religion alone was not sufficient.
Not enough.
And it caused conflicts within the village area. But, and I think in a case like that, one could say there is an element of harm.
Yes, there is a benefit from it. That's right. But I'm very happy now to see the young Native people going to college, getting an education, and taking, you know, becoming the leaders of their own people. I think that's wonderful. And mixing, I know Dix went to the legislature for 4 years, and it was interesting to watch those people from, you know, way up north. When the girls would come, they were shy, but they soon. You know, and I think Neva Egan helped them as much as anything. She was so marvelous when they'd come. They were always invited with everybody else. And she was just, I just used to watch that. The first time they'd come so shy and hang their heads, and the next time they were a little bit more at home. And so they got really as though they felt very at home, you know, with her. And I thought that was a remarkable thing.
Oh, yes.
I think she's quite a person anyway. I like Neva Egan. Of course, my husband happened to be Democrat that time. And personally, I can honestly say I'm not too conscious of parties. I still think that we had a good system in the territorial days when we, you know, it was the man that we voted for rather than the party.
Yes, I feel this way. And I don't know, this really is no longer true in Alaska. It's very party conscious now. But I register independent because I am for the man.
Yes,
for the person.
I think that's the way it should be myself. That's the way I believe it should be.
But Mrs. Egan has been a very sensitive person, hasn't she?
Yes.
People's needs, and she was from Valdez, was she not?
She was a high school teacher in Valdez when she met Bill.
Yes.
They had a little store there.
Yes. Now, your husband was in the legislature.
Yes, he was in the Senate for 4 years.
Do you not want me to turn this off at all?
Big fine.
Do you need for me to turn this off?
I can't hear you.
You just said that you didn't feel that you had much to contribute because you've just lived along your life. You've observed changes in many different parts.
Oh, my. Absolutely.
And, for example, the Bethel area in the 20s.
I would never know Bethel, I'm sure.
There's 2,000 or 3,000 people now.
I know it. I can't hardly believe that. I can't imagine. When we were there, the river had just started eating back, you know, and I understand the town has moved back and back and back on the tundra. But that year, it started to eat in, you see, into the village. And I understand. You see, NC used to have great, huge warehouses along the waterfront there, and they all went. And the island where the boat landed also went, you see.
I didn't know there was an island.
Yes, there was an island, and that's where, I think it was about 100 miles up, and they piloted you up the tupper, the freighter that went in there, up the river, and it landed on that island, and all the freight was landed on that island, and then taken across to the shore, you see. And that island is gone, I understand. There is no more. And I'm sure where we lived is gone, and the warehouses are gone.
I see.
And they kept moving back. They keep moving back on the tundra, you see.
Yes, yes. Because the river is very wide.
So I can hardly visualize, you see, what it is now. Well, I can't, that's all. And the whole atmosphere of the village has changed. There was no liquor in that time. Of course, the natives had their own liquor that they made. But I guess it's quite a town for liquor now.
Yes, I guess it is. I guess it is.
But it wasn't in those years.
Now, in the 4 years you were there, and your husband was with the Northern Commercial Company. Didn't
yes,
you? Did you had to get into the Eskimo community a little bit.
Yes, yes.
Acquaintance-wise.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about them?
Well, to me, they're very gentle people. They love their children. Their children are spoiled, but they love them. They lived as the Eskimo did. They didn't furniture was of no necessity to them. You know, their skins, and there might be 10 people sleeping in one room. They all lived in one room. The whole process of life went on, I guess, in that one room, you see. And they were friendly people. We enjoyed them, and I enjoyed the Eskimo people very much. And my children played with the Eskimo children, which always sort of provoked me when I'd hear sometimes the NC agents' wives wouldn't allow their children to play with the NC. The very people who made it possible for them to be there. And it was nothing. And we used to take the Denver Post. My husband had been in Colorado, and he took the daily Denver Post. Well, it was in the years before airmail. So we'd get just
Oh. I was just thinking 3 or 4 months late.
That's right. But the funny papers. And so all the little Eskimo children would come into the house, and we'd open the papers and take out the funny, and they loved to be, and we'd read to them. And they loved to be read to anyway. And when we'd read to our children, they read, they came to listen, you know, too. And I saw, I remember there was a rug on the floor, so I took that up and put Congolian rug down, because the hair off their parkies and their boots and everything was hard to get off the rug. So really, it was enjoyable for our children, and they learned a lot. And I'll have to admit, they never knew there was any color difference, anything, until we came up here, and I happened to show them a picture one day of a little boy down there. Well, they said, Mother, Clyde, he looks different. And they never, when they lived among them, and they even talked like him. I took them out to my mother's one time in Seattle. She was horrified to think that I would live where my children talk like that. And people told me afterward up here, I didn't notice it. I didn't notice they had that same, you know, cadence to their voices that the Eskimo kids did. But I always thought it was valuable to them rather than any harm to be down there among those children. And I really enjoyed them. And I think the Eskimo as a whole was a pretty honest man myself. And they were interesting in the store. I didn't work in the store or anything, but Dick said they'd come in. And you see, for a long time down there, some of these big traders, and particularly the man that the NC bought out, had his own, you can say script or money or whatever you want to say. And that's what they had to use because they were trying to keep out the fur buyers from coming in and offering those people money. And so they wouldn't take money. They would take the script, but they wouldn't take the money. So those people, I thought that was a shame. I thought that was dishonest of the trader. But I think the trader has a lot to be, you know, to account for, too, really.
Can you tell me what you mean by that?
Big pardon?
Can you elaborate on that remark?
Well, I just feel like they use the native. They'd get their fur for practically nothing, and then, of course, they would send it out to be sold. And I think the native was used in every way. I think some of the missionaries used the native for the things that they wanted from them. And they'd give them an old dress or a piece of candy or something like that, and that's what they did. And so finally, when the NC came in, they did away with that script. They could use money. And so when these natives would come from the lower, more toward the Bering Sea and those villages out there, my husband said they'd stand a lot. Well, first of all, if the native comes in the store and you don't go up and ask him what he wants, he spends 2 or 3 days just looking around to see what they have and what he might want. And Dick said this one time this man had wanted a gun. He looked at the guns and he looked at the gun, and finally he came up to my husband and he said, would you take this? And he showed Dick's money, you see. And Dick said, well, I certainly will take that. But you see, they weren't used to that. They were used to being governed entirely by what that trader said.
I see. So it was not a Northern Commercial Company trading post script.
To begin with.
No, it was the trader that published
it. It was the trader, that's right.
It wasn't then a...
Northern Commercial Company, they stopped it. They did away with the script. It was the man that held it before, and he had become a very wealthy man. He was out of San Francisco and went back to San Francisco when he sold it. And I just never could quite respect that man like I would like to, because I felt that he used those natives every way that he could.
That's the most interesting.
And right now I feel that way about the natives in the liquor business, these traders in the liquor business. What are they doing to the native? They get everything out of him that they can without, you know. And I just say, I do. I feel very strongly about that liquor business in the villages. I watched it.
Yes,
I know.
Yes.
And there was no liquor down there, you see, at all. It was a dry village, except their own native brew that they used to make themselves.
How did they make that? I wonder where they got that. It must have been from the Russians.
It must have been, because the Russians were all through that country down there, you know. And they talk about wars down there between the tribes of the Eskimo and the Russians and the Eskimo.
Is that?
Yes, right? They talk about wars. And one time the Russians came in and brought smallpox in, and hundreds of them died. I'll tell you who used to come in there was Dr. Hardlicka from the Smithsonian Institute.
Oh, yes.
And he was in there when we were down there.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, he was very opposed, you see. The natives were very opposed. They wouldn't even go near his boat because he went to the cemeteries and dug up the remains of their ancestors.
Yes.
And they were very, very angry about that, you see.
As an anthropologist, I will say that, and in anthropology they refer to him as Herdyshka, But anyway, they say that he's just in disrepute. They say he was a very bad anthropologist. Yeah. He went around and he dug at random.
Yes.
Without keeping records, and without the respect of the local
and they
people.
Did not respect those him at all. In fact, they wouldn't touch his boat. They wouldn't go near it. They were that superstitious, you see.
Isn't that too bad? I can understand that they wouldn't want to touch his boat that carried the remains of their ancestors.
Yes.
But still, he also didn't respect their traditions.
No, he did not. And I know he was there while we were there.
But you did meet him.
Oh, yes, I met Dr. Hardwick, I guess.
What sort of person was he?
Well, he was very sure of himself, and his profession was his whole life, you see. And he was quite an elderly man when he came. I think he came twice. And I suppose he was interesting in his way, but I don't know. I had such feelings for what he was doing and also for the natives and how they felt, you know. Too.
Yes, yes. So, in other words, he did alienate people.
Yes, he did. Yes, he alienated those natives down there. Yes, indeed.
Going back into some of their customs, and I've got to go too, but were they practicing open ground burials? Were they?
Yes, they were.
It really wasn't too difficult for him to gather his stuff.
No, it wasn't, no. And their possessions were there, you know, on the graves. And their guns would be hanging on the horns that they put up.
They had a ceremony down in that country where they went around. I don't know if they got it from the Russians or whether it was actually went to the pre-Russian time, but I think maybe they incorporated some of the Christian and Russian ceremonial or theatrics, but it was a winter pageant. The inviting in ceremony and the bladder festival were a couple of. And they would go door to door and give out gifts and announce.
Yeah. You aren't thinking of a potlatch, are you, or something like that?
Well, no.
Where they would bring bolts of gingham and a village would have a festival, and they said they would string bolts of village of gingham and anything. They gave away practically everything they had.
And they do that in Bethel?
I never saw that at Bethel.
No, that was Southeastern.
No, I never saw that. They still had the kajim, the men's place where the men's went to bathe,
yes,
you know. They
yes,
still had
yes,
that. Yeah. And I know we went to see dances one time, and we went into this kajim, and they had to scooch way low, you know, and get in. And they did their native dances. And it was very, very nice, you know. And of course, it's always interesting because so much of it is a takeoff on the white man. And we were all, I wish I could remember my Eskimo name. And, of course, I was one of the biggest women they had ever seen, you see. And
that was, how tall are you?
Well, I was 5'10½", I think, you know. So I was a very tall person. And I wasn't, you know, and had big feet. And they never could get over that because, you see, they have short. And they tried to get them to make me something. It was just almost impossible. They couldn't visualize, you see, a woman with big feet.
Isn't that interesting?
Uh-huh. But you see, the girls down there, another trader by the name of Hall worked with Dix. And his wife was Russian. She was a very interesting woman, too, and very nice, spoke very English, very fluently and all. So they had this big family. And so the girls used to tell me what the natives used to say, and it really was funny. It never offended me. It was just funny because I could see that. Here were these little squat people with feet about this long, and here were mine about this long, you know, and a little hand. And they just couldn't get over that. But they were fun to be with, too. And they're great mimics. One year I took out a boy and a girl. The father wanted to take the boy out, but he had to have his tonsils out. And the girl, they just wanted her to go out, and she went to Holy Names in Seattle. It was interesting to watch those children. I thought they would just be overcome by all the big buildings, but they weren't. You see, they had a picture show at Bethel. Those terrible pictures, I should say to Dixie, and Seattle be ashamed of themselves to show these people and let them think that's what life is, you know, on the outside. But they never missed a thing. And I always tell us, it was just kind of funny. When we set the table, because we lived in a village and my children were growing up there a bit, I thought that I should be very careful about what I did in my home. So I was quite particular about how the table was set, and, you know, just the things that you are. But, you know, he was in a village, I guess it didn't matter, but it did to me because I didn't want them to grow up that way. And so I was so amused at Carl one day. We sat down at the dinner table, and he was so incensed because one of the children had forgotten to put salad forks on. Now, I dare say he had never known what a salad fork, but, boy, they adapt themselves very well.
And who was it that was incensed?
an Eskimo boy that I took out, this little Eskimo boy. He was so incensed at this other child who had set the table because he hadn't put,
neglected to put the
salad forks on.
He knew.
And he knew, you see. And he was very particular, and he was very proud of the fact. And I bought them nice clothing. Their parents gave me the money, and I bought them nice clothing. And Carl was very fortunate. He had a teacher who made him, and he took his parka. I told him, "Now take your parka and your boots and the things that you use up here, because the children out there will be very interested." And they had him come to every room in the school, and he just loved it. And the teacher made him feel like he really, you know, was something. And he really had a wonderful year out there that year. And he adapted himself very, very well to the whole thing.
That's most interesting.
Yes, it is. My own parents were quite surprised that I would do that and bring them out. They thought the idea, but I didn't care. They were people to me. Hello.
Hi. I'm just about to leave here. Don't go away, because I'm making a tape, but we're visiting. But I had a 12 o'clock appointment. I'm a little late. But Mrs. Hall is so interesting. I couldn't bear myself to bring myself.
Well, I can't imagine that. I appreciate